This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It wasn't a music show at the Echoplex last night, but the joint was rocking in Echo Park. That's where the Bernie Sanders campaign in Southern California celebrated a Golden State win.
Nearly a million doors in Los Angeles County alone.
They were truly excited there at the Echoplex, and KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb was there too. Sounded like quite a party, Benjamin.
It definitely was, Steve. And really in typical Echo Park style, you had a crowd of mostly younger Bernie Sanders supporters, diverse Bernie Sanders supporters, and an eclectic crowd. They were really psyched about his win in California, but also, I've got to say, kind of worried about how well Joe Biden did, particularly in Texas.
Well, all the headlines have been about last night's surprising results. We just heard about Maine going to Joe Biden. The presidential primary, the sudden resurgence of the former vice president, of course, the long lines of people waiting in line at LA County's new voting system. That was a big news item yesterday. Supervisor Janice Hahn saying she wants an investigation, saying that the county needs to launch, quote, a forensic autopsy of what happened. Now, all that said, we had a bunch of interesting local races in LA. A lot of those results are trickling in today. Rafe Sonnenschein is executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. He joins us now to take a look at what last night's election means for the local politics going forward. Rafe, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Let us start with that race, a big one for district attorney in LA County. We don't have a final count yet. We can say, though, that all the races don't have those final counts yet, but the results in the DA's race are surprising some folks right now.
Well, a lot of people wrote Jackie Lacey off in this incredibly important race. This is the only race that can be seen from the moon. In other words, this is a nationally significant race in L.A., and she is hovering around 50.7%, which is what she would need to avoid a runoff. She really needs to avoid a runoff because she's running against two candidates who split the rest of the votes and will probably endorse each other, George Gascon and Rachel Rossi. This is the big battle over law enforcement practices and the changing politics of district attorney races that have changed since she was elected in 2012, and she's been kind of caught in the slipstream.
And certainly Gascon has made that a campaign issue, moving back to Los Angeles from San Francisco, where he served as DA up in the Bay Area. You mentioned, Rafe, that she, Jackie Lacey, is about 50.7% right now. Do you think that's going to hold?
I just can't tell because we have no idea of the tens, hundreds of thousands of votes yet to come in. And this is a race that crosses a lot of lines in terms of race, age, gender. This whole law enforcement battle is a war all to itself, separate from the presidential race. I don't know if she can hold on, but it sure would be important for her camp to be over 50% and not have to have months and months of a very tough runoff.
I mean, a couple of years ago, we thought Jim McDonnell, the LA County Sheriff, was going to move to victory, right, to get reelected. And then Alex Villanueva came up with, you know, a turn there.
Yes, and actually district attorneys have an even harder time getting reelected, especially if they have celebrity trials, which often kind of doom them. It's a very tough office to hold. She's held it for two straight terms, which is quite something. Yeah. Getting the third one is turning out to be a real heavy lift.
Benjamin, I want to turn to the Board of Supervisors. Three of the five seats on the board were up for re-election. Give us an update of what happened there.
Yeah, and Steve, these are some of the most important races, frankly, in all of Los Angeles County. I mean, each supervisor represents about 2 million people, and we had three seats up for grabs. In the 4th District, incumbent Janice Hahn easily won re-election, about 75% of the vote right now. In the 5th District, this is Northern LA County, from Pasadena and Glendale up to the current County line. More conservative part of LA County. Looks like the incumbent Catherine Barger has won re-election. But then there's District 2, South LA, out to Venice and down into the Carson area. Mark Ridley Thomas is termed out, and it looks like that race is heading for a runoff election between Herb Wesson, the former president of the LA City Council, and State Senator Holly Mitchell.
An interesting race for sure. Rafe Sonnenschein, former City Councilwoman Jan Perry, was also in that race in District 2. She didn't make the runoff. What are your thoughts on two and the runoff between Mitchell and Wesson?
This is a very important race, not just because it's a powerful office, because it says a lot about the changing nature of housing and homeless issues in the African-American community in Los Angeles, which is a vital issue. And it's probably going to split generations in some ways. I think this, you could see the Wesson Mitchell thing coming a mile away, that they're going to be talking about the future of housing homelessness and affordability issues in that district. It's going to be really an amazing race.
Certainly a big story in L.A., L.A. City and L.A. County. Speaking of the city, Benjamin, 7 city council seats were up for the grabs yesterday. What are the highlights there?
So the main highlights, almost all of the incumbents were reelected with more than 50%. That includes John Lee, Paul Krikorian, the current city council president, Nori Martinez, and Marquise Harris Dawson. It's also looking like former state senator Kevin De Leon, who also wrote the state's sanctuary state law, also won outright in Jose Huizar's 14th district. That's downtown to the Glassell Park area. But returning councilman David Ryu is getting a tough challenge in the 4th district, despite spending some big-time money. You've got Nithya Raman, who's challenging him there, has support from L.A. groups that support Bernie Sanders. Mark Ridley Thomas, we mentioned, termed out of the 2nd district in L.A. County supervisor's race. He is headed for a runoff to replace Herb Wesson in the 10th city council district.
Rafe, I want to bring you back in because the Herb Wesson and Mark Ridley Thomas flip-flop, right, is an interesting story there, and I want to get to David Ryu, too. Let's start with Wesson and Ridley Thomas.
Well, it is. I mean, these are two heavyweight politicians in Los Angeles, and Mark Ridley Thomas served in the city council for 2 terms and has a chance at a 3rd term. He can only serve 1 more term, whereas Wesson can serve 12 years, 3 terms, in the county supervisors. I think that Mark Ridley Thomas has probably a clearer road to winning than Wesson does. I think Wesson's is going to go down to the wire. I think it's going to be a really difficult, challenging race for both those candidates. It would be hard for me to see Mark Ridley Thomas, with his high level of recognition in government, not winning a runoff in that race.
Benjamin, and what about David Ryu, by the way, Rafe, before we move on? David Ryu is having a tough time in his district. What are the factors there, do you think?
He is, and I think he's being challenged from the left on the homelessness issue, which, as you can imagine, no city council member in Los Angeles feels safe around the issue of homelessness. You're, on the one hand, expected to deal with the issue, and you also have neighbors and residents who are angry at you for actually dealing with the issue. He's pretty popular, but he's got a strong challenge here, and the second place candidate is not far behind him. I think that could be a close race. I think it could be quite close down the road as well.
And finally, Rafe, Measure R, one about civilian oversight of the sheriff's department, seems to have passed handily. What does it do?
Well, thanks for asking me, because nobody's been asking me about this one. I think this is a really important measure. This would allow the Citizens Commission on Civilian Oversight of the Sheriff's Department to issue subpoenas to gather information from the sheriff. And for those who have been following this, the sheriff and the county supervisors, the inspector general, and the Citizens Commission have had a heck of a time getting information from the sheriff. This battle is going to end up, I think, eventually in state law battles. And this law will probably end up in court over subpoena battles, but it's a really big deal.
All right. Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Rafe, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
And KCRW reporter Benjamin Gottlieb. Ben, thanks.
Anytime.
All right, let's move on now with more election results. And Orange and San Diego counties also featured some high-profile races as well. And for some analysis on how voting went there, we're joined now by Thad Kauser, who's a professor of political science at UC San Diego. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in your neck of the woods, San Diego. This is the 50th congressional district that's been getting a lot of attention since Duncan Hunter resigned. Tell us a little bit about that district and what yesterday's election results look like there.
Yeah, so this district is one of the reddest in California, but surprisingly, in 2018, Amar Kampanajar, a Democratic upstart, nearly knocked off Duncan Hunter. Duncan Hunter is now out and likely headed towards federal prison. Daryl Issa is now the presumptive frontrunner going into November. So remember, he's the longtime congressman from the 49th congressional district. He backed out of that race when things looked bad in 2018. He got into this race when Duncan Hunter looked like he was headed towards prison. And so far, he's the leading Republican vote getter with 25% of the vote, closely followed by Carl DeMaio, former city councilman, with 21% of the vote. Amar Kampanajar, the Democrat, is back again, and he pulled the most votes, punching his ticket through to November with 34%, but there are a lot of Republican votes out there in this very red district.
It's a very red district, and we'll see what the down-ballot ticket does prove in November. You've also been watching the race down there in San Diego. Kevin Faulkner, the current mayor, a Republican, but is the city of San Diego, like much of Orange County, starting to at least turn blue a little bit?
Absolutely. Potentially a very dark shade of blue. So this has been the political transformation of coastal California that we've seen come to full fruition in 2018. And San Diego, which currently has a Republican mayor, may have only two Democrats making it through to the runoff in November. So right now, Todd Gloria, who's an assembly member, used to be the head of the city council, the interim mayor and on the city council, he's been dominant in this race. He has 40% of the vote. He'll go through to November. But his two challengers are neck and neck. Scott Sherman, a Republican city council member, Barbara Bree, a Democratic city council member, are within one percentage point. So we may have a guaranteed Democratic victory or just an all but assured Democratic victory in a city that's for a long time been a Republican bastion. Yeah,
certainly a shift there. Let's talk more about Orange County, going back to congressional districts. A high-profile seat is the 25th congressional district. Democrat Katie Hill turned that seat blue a couple of years ago, but she stepped down amid scandal. What happened last night there?
Yeah, so this seat based up in Clarita in the North Valley is one of the big surprises. So this one had a field that it almost looked like the field in the recall. You had lots and lots of people, YouTube hosts, George Papadopoulos getting into this, a lot of craziness. But you have a very established Democrat, Christy Smith, who got 30% of the vote. She'll go through to being the Democrat facing in November. But on the Republican side, looks right now that a big upset is brewing. Steve Knight used to hold the seat in Congress. He has come from a brand name political family in that area, and it looks like right now he's trailing by about 6 percentage points. Mike Garcia, a newcomer Republican who ran on the right, he's a former Navy pilot, reflects the increasing diversity of the district, and right now holds a 26% to 20% lead over Steve Knight to go through to November.
All right, from the 25th in Northern LA County, let's switch back now to Orange County because the 39th. Congressional district is a big one. That's one of four seats in the OC that turned from red to blue. Gil Cisnero was the Democrat that won the seat in a very close race then. How's that looking this time around?
Yeah, so this luck of this former lottery runner may be changing. The initial results so far have Gil Cisnero at 44% and Young Kim, who is the Republican incumbent he replaced 2 years ago, making a comeback with 51%. The caveat we should have on all these votes is we've probably got about 60% of California ballots counted so far compared to when we're comparing this to the primary in 2016 and the growth of the electorate since then. One thing we know from recent years in California is ballots that are counted earliest tend to favor Republicans, and then it tends to be a blue shift as we count more and more ballots. So things could even up for Gil Cisneros, but right now he's trailing by a lot to Young Kim.
And yeah, we did see that a couple of years ago, right? Because we weren't sure whether those precincts, those congressional districts were going to turn blue, and then by day after day, we started seeing that shift to blue. So we will see in the coming days. I think it's also interesting, obviously, it was a close race. We're also on the topic of Orange County, how relatively smoothly Orange County voting went yesterday, right, as opposed to L.A. County. Both counties had new voting systems in place, but L.A. saw the long lines, reported issues with the technology. Why do you think the OC did so much better?
Yeah, so both of these counties adopted the new Voters Choice Act, but there are three big differences. So the Voters Choice Act moves from neighborhood polling places to voting by mail and voting at vote centers. First, Orange County voters just vote by mail more often than LA County voters long before this reform. LA County voters vote in person far more than anyone else in the rest of the state. So it was a bigger shift for LA voters. Second, they were both adopting sort of different laws. So LA had a special carve out in its version of the Voters' Choice Act, which allowed it to move towards vote centers but not have to mail vote-by-mail absentee ballots to all voters. Orange County did, and so that might have led more voters to vote early and through the mail rather than trying to show up and overcrowding a vote center. And the third, LA was doing a major shift in its technology, and it seems that the choke points were the technology, the new voting tablets and the sign-in system to get registered for them. That's what led to the really long lines that the LA County Registrar is going to be working over time between now and November to make sure that that doesn't repeat itself.
And that registrar recorder, Dean Logan, saying that, hey, look, we really need to take a look at this and try and make it better. He took a lot of responsibility for it. It was a new system. There was that bottleneck that you mentioned at the check-in, between the check-in and then to the touchscreens themselves. I witnessed it myself when I went to vote, and I know It was hours for some folks who tried to vote yesterday. So in L.A. County, certainly it was a problem, and we'll see how much they get fixed. I want to thank you, Thad Couser, professor of political science at UC San Diego. Thad, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, coming up, there's a stage play going on in Echo Park that centers on the so-called King of Pop. Well, more like the King of Pop's sparkly glove. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, we're off to the Carl Sagan and Andrianne Theater in Echo Park, where there's a new musical playing. It's called For the Love of a Glove, and it tells the story of Michael Jackson's life from the perspective of his glove. This is the very first performance to take the stage at this theater. It's run by the Center for Inquiry, a nonprofit that was created by Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov with a mission to foster a secular society based on reason, science, freedom of inquiry, and humanist values. And what better way to foster humanist values than with a musical about aliens? Oh yeah, did I mention that in this musical, Michael Jackson's glove is an alien from outer space? Some think I'm just a glove, but they don't know how wrong they are. So buckle up, because we're headed to the planet of Bassalam with KCRW's David Weinberg. And just a warning for any parents listening, this play and this story about the play deal in adult themes that might not be appropriate for kids.
Julian Nitzberg, the writer and director of For the Love of a Glove, first got the idea for the story 17 years ago when he was approached by some studio executives who wanted him to write a movie about Michael Jackson.
When you're writing a biopic, you want to understand the person and sympathize with them. And even though I'd done a ton of research and I was a giant Michael Jackson fan since I was a kid, I couldn't make sense of his life.
One of the questions Julian had for the executives was how he should handle the sexual abuse allegations against Jackson. At the time, Jackson had been acquitted in court, and so any accusations that made their way into the movie could give him grounds for a libel suit.
And I went home and I thought about it. I started thinking about, you know, my favorite absurdist writers like, you know, Eugene Ionesco or Nikolai Gogol and all these people who took, you know, or Franz Kafka who took a weird situation and then like put an extra weird take on it to make it more, you know, have a surreal sense to it. And I came back and I said, what if Michael Jackson's glove was an alien from outer space? And he's the one who was responsible for all the bad things Michael Jackson did. Basically, you know, to be a little pretentious, you know, he's Michael's Jungian shadow self. I told the network this and they laughed and said, that is the funniest pitch we've ever heard, but can you do, and they didn't say the word cheesy, but they said, can you do the normal version, which is the cheesy version? And, you know, I wanted this to deal with bigger social issues. I wanted this to deal with racism, cultural appropriation. How did this impact Michael Jackson growing up? How did being Jehovah's Witness impact Michael Jackson growing up? And that's not what a TV network wants to deal with. And so I said no to the job, even though it was a nice check, because I just was like, I don't want to write a cheesy Michael Jackson movie. I want to do something really interesting.
About 4 years after that meeting, Julian directed a completely different project, a musical that became a cult sensation. Just a quick shout out, if you are familiar with the Beastly Bombing operetta, and the experience gave Julian the idea to turn his Jackson Alien glove concept into a musical for the stage. So he came up with the lyrics for a few songs and then reached out to composers Drew Erickson, Max Townsley, and Nicole Maurier, a songwriter who works with pop stars like Britney Spears and Selena Gomez. She had never done a musical before.
It was very interesting for me because as a pop songwriter, I tend to start with a melody and a very simple, like, 3-minute structure song. With the musical, it was really hard because we'd get sometimes a full page of lyrics with a song that would end up being 9 minutes long if we kind of used everything, and then to condense it and simplify and make like a catchy chorus part out of it was a challenge.
While Nicole and the other composers started writing and recording demos of the songs, Julian worked on the script and casting.
So the first act of the show is the Jackson 5 years. So I wrote this, not really thinking it through, and the show is really filthy and political. I'm like, I can't cast a 10-year-old kid in this show. And then, of course, how am I going to do aliens? And so it quickly became puppets.
Yes, puppets. There are two distinct types of puppets in the play. One is a Japanese-style puppet called Bunraku. These are life-size puppets that attach to the front of the actors who play the Jackson 5 as kids. Robin Walsh is a puppeteer and puppet designer.
So the puppeteer stands behind them, and they have one hand in the head, moving the head and the mouth. The other hand can move the arms, and then their legs are attached to the feet or the shins of the puppets. So they can dance, they can sing, they can do whatever they need to. And the other ones are literal glove puppets, where it's a glove that happens to have eyes that light up and a mouth that can move.
One of the biggest challenges of this production was taking a cast of actors who had no experience with puppets and teaching them the art of puppetry.
Because what we tell the performers is, the way we approach, or I approach, puppetry is you don't really control or manipulate it. It's something that you work with. And ideally, the puppet leads you. It tells you what to do. So since it's a musical and there's dancing, the nice analogy there is it's a duet.
With the puppeteers diligently building puppets, Julian started casting the show. And by this time, he had recorded demos of the songs that he sent out to auditioning actors, including Tracy Dory. He plays Jermaine Jackson, Bubbles the Chimp, and the understudy to Michael Jackson. When he first heard the songs in the musical, he was shocked.
And I was just listening to it while I was doing some cleaning around the house. And I was listening, and I was like, oh, this is what we're doing? Okay. Wow, that is some really heinous stuff that's being said. But damn it, if this song is catchy.
It was one song in particular that really got to him. A song called What a Delight to Be White, which is sung by Justin Anthony Long, who plays Donny Osmond. In real life, Osmond is Mormon, and in this scene, Osmond explains to Michael Jackson that he will become white after his death if he converts to Mormonism.
What a delight, what a sight, when you become white. What a delight when you become white. No longer devilishly dark as the dead of night, but blindingly, beautifully, heavenly bright. No longer the mark of Cain, your skin will indite.
And all these things will happen to you. Your hair is going to become straight. Your nose will shrink. Your penis will also shrink. And, you know, policemen aren't going to shoot you. Old ladies won't be frightened of you. And it was one thing hearing Donnie say it, but then Michael repeats it back. And he's kind of happy in the song. And I'm just like, oh, no. No, 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 no. This is not okay.
What a delight when I become white.
No. Experiencing that for the first time without having read the script, I was like, whoa, okay. Yeah, this is, I'm kind of angry listening to this song. But, you know, it's all in satire, so I suppose it might be doing its job then.
What a sight, what a delight when I come white.
The question of how far satire is allowed to go before it crosses a line was at the center of a media storm about the production before it even opened. A few months ago, news outlets reported that Johnny Depp was producing a musical about Michael Jackson as told by his glove, and the internet whipped into a frenzy of hot takes. But it turned out that Depp was not involved in the musical, and the media has since moved on. The show has been playing for weeks now with little controversy, despite the particularly biting critique of religion, especially the beliefs of Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses. Michael Jackson was raised a Jehovah's Witness, and one of the central storylines is built around the belief some Jehovah's Witnesses have that masturbation is a sin because it can lead to homosexuality.
Gay!
One of my favorite songs in the show is a powerful gospel number sung by Suzanne Nichols, who plays Michael Jackson's mother. The song is called Don't Masturbate. The show is not for kids, or anyone who might take offense to penis jokes. And in this version of Michael Jackson's life, Michael is the victim. He thinks sleepovers with young boys are creepy. It's his glove that makes him do it, because it needs to feed off of the blood of virgins. And in that way, the musical creates a world where everything in Michael Jackson's life makes sense. While it is absurd and raunchy, the world Julian has created is a world that has its own logic. And like any good satire, the moments of absurdity shed light on the darker aspects of reality, both in terms of the racism the Jacksons faced and in Michael Jackson's own transgressions. The show runs through March 22nd. For KCRW, I'm David Weinberg.
This show is ending right now. Thanks for being here, for your ears, and for your time. Have a great Wednesday.
Sometimes just has to stay.